Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garb from Everyone Loves Guitar, and today we've got a super interesting and really accomplished lead guitarist with us. We're here with Jason Slim Gamble. Slim's the lead guitarist for the multi-platinum Capitol Nashville recording artist Lady Antebellum, and they've sold more than, check this out, 18 million albums worldwide, racked up 7 Grammys and countless CMA and ACM awards, and they've had 9 number one songs. And Slim's been there for all of it, not only as a touring side musician, but also as a session player on every single Paul Worley produced album, and he's appeared as a songwriter on 4 of their songs. In addition, Slim's performed in a house band on NBC's Last Call with Carson Daly. He's toured with Tyler Hilton and Josh Kelly, done sessions with some of the biggest names in music, and he's found himself on stage with John Mayer, Christina Aguilera, Stevie Nicks, members of Maroon 5, Rob Thomas, Vanessa Carlton, Macy Gray, Peter Frampton, Kenny Chesney, Earth, Wind & Fire, and countless others. Man, I'm exhausted just from reading that.
has appeared on stage with. That's the resume.
Yeah, yeah. That was the big one. It was like one big one. But man, hey, and more.
The funny thing is, I forgot to even admit, like, doing the Charles Kelly solo tour like last year, which was a huge chunk of my year. But you know, it kind of all connects to Lady A. So it's all. I'd be nothing if it wasn't for the Kelly family.
Well, that's awesome, man. Well, congratulations and thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited. Got a lot of good buddies that have done your show, so
well, fun stuff. Also, congratulations. You and your wife recently had your second child, Lila Marie.
Yes, sir. Yeah, man. She's 6 weeks old.
That's awesome, man.
She's just a little cabbage patch kid. She's awesome.
Very cool. Very cool. So you'll be busy. You won't be getting sleep. Now that you're home from tour, you won't be able to sleep.
Yeah, it's funny. I always think I'll go on tour and get sleep, and then I, you know, don't and come home and don't sleep. So it's, I've never been a great sleeper, so it's all good.
Well, that being said, Slim is like 15 years younger looking than what I would have ever mistaken him for. So maybe that's the secret. I've been focusing on trying to get sleep. Maybe I got it all backwards, man.
I had a whole makeup crew and some lighting guys come in earlier to make me look good. So.
It worked. Let me tell you. It worked. Hey, you know, it's very unusual, especially in Nashville, for a touring musician to also play on the albums, and you've done that all with Lady A. So my questions are, how did you get the gig initially, and can you maybe discuss the dynamics, at least for yourself, you know, as to why this situation is so different and what, you know, that's very rare, as you know.
Yeah, I think honestly it just comes down to friendships I've had for a long time. And what I mean by that is I toured with the lead singer, Lady A, one of them is Charles Kelly, and I toured with his brother, Josh. And so Charles was a good buddy of mine, and we'd been hanging out and writing songs together for a minute when he and Dave and Hillary put Lady Antebellum together. And it was just, I came out to Nashville because every time I talked to him, he was talking about this band he had together, and we need a guitar player, and we'll write songs, and we'll live at my brother's house, which was a fully furnished 5,000 square foot house in Franklin that no one lived in. So it worked out, but side note. But yeah, so I kind of almost on a whim, just threw my gear in the car and drove to Nashville. And, you know, we hung out and made music and had a good time. And then when it came time they signed their record deal a couple months after I got there and, invited me to play on the first record, which, you know, honestly, I never spent a lot of time in Nashville. And I never met the producer, but the producer, Paul Worley, who's obviously a legend, just rolled the dice. And they said, oh, our buddy Slim's a Southern rock guy. Like, we should have him on it. And he says, okay. And, you know, and then I guess I hung in there well enough. The process, the Nashville recording process was different than anything I'd ever experienced.
In
the way it's very structured. I got the first email that said, we're doing these dates, 10s and 2s. I said, what's 10s and 2s? And that's a 10 to 1 and a 2 to 5.
Right.
And that's how they do it. And they crank through it, and they have a certain way of charting songs, the Nashville number system. Mm-hmm. And there's just the process of the day was different because everything is a keeper. I was used to doing records where you go in and track with a full band, and the point of the full band is for vibe, so everyone's rocking. But then you go back in and you touch up parts and you sit there and do overdubs and you like really work stuff out. And I didn't really realize this until after the first record was done. I'm like, wait, I'm not going back to go and go change my parts. Like that was it. Just completely whatever hit me that day. That's what's on the record. And, you know, lesson learned.
Right. Right. You know,
it is a really, really fast process. And that's how they've been working in Nashville for decades and decades. So yeah, it was a different thing. And so, you know, Paul and Dave and Charles and Hillary all completely took a chance on me being in the studio. And I guess I did a good enough job to get invited back for the next record, which is kind of another Nashville thing, is just loyalty. Like the first record blew up and they said, okay, well, this is obviously a good team, so we'll do it the same way for the second record. And then, you know, the next couple, kind of same story. And so, yeah, that's how that came to pass. Like, honestly, I was in the studio with them before I was touring with them, because they hadn't toured yet.
Sure.
So I had, like, done a couple little spot dates, but I was basically, like, in town. I didn't even officially live in Nashville, but they brought me in the studio, and then they started booking tour dates, and I started doing that with them. One thing led to another, and I landed full-time in Nashville. So, you know, ultimately, that's how that came to pass. It wasn't like I was out on tour with them and we were doing all these dates, and then I ended up in the studio band. It was kind of the other way around, and it just ended up where I was doing both at the same time. And also the other thing was, from my perspective as a guy that came from Los Angeles, like that wasn't such an unusual thing in my mind. I was a little bit thrown off by how I got that question a lot those first few years. It's like, whoa, you're like, you played in the studio and you wrote songs with them too. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm a musician. Like, we write songs and we produce and we do all sorts of, we do music, right? But so, it's yeah. Not quite that way in Nashville. It is definitely like there's one set of guys that do this, and there's a set of guys that do this, and a set of guys that do this, and there's rarely an overlap. I think that paradigm is shifting very, very gradually.
Yes.
But ultimately it is still kind of that. So I got really lucky, and stuff just kind of fell into place, and my friends like invited me to do their record with them, and then their record did well. So I just, it just kind of worked out in my favor in that particular case. But it is a fortunate thing that I landed on.
But you made a comment. You said they're very lucky. After they did the first album, they called me back. Is that not the norm? If you have a great first album, do you suddenly say, okay, let's get some new guys?
I don't know, because in LA, I never played on a massive multi-platinum album that was an artist's first album.
Yeah, I hear you.
But my understanding of it has always been definitely that I know pop artists, like, they jump producers like they're changing socks, you know? Like, I mean, a lot of pop records now will have 8 or 10 different producers and writers, so, like, everything's a different lineup. So,
interesting.
You know, I'm sure producers might call the same guys back, but, you know, I don't know. I never really quite got in those circles, so I don't know. But when I look at liner notes, like, yeah, there's a lot of guys on pop records, and country records tend to be like, this is the band for the record, and then you look at the artist's next record, and if it's with the same producer, it tends to be at least a similar lineup.
Yes.
Once an artist jumps to a different producer, it's whoever the producer decides to call, you know? But yeah, to answer your question, I would think it would be that way. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
You'd think.
But, you know, people get bored. They yeah. just got to, sometimes stuff changes just for the sake of change too, you know?
By the way, I'm looking at a wall of Slim's. He's got a acoustic / like, it's really hard to focus because I'm just looking at it. I'm like, man, I'd like to play that yellow canary Strat. And now that's a cool looking telly. And that's a nice looking Gill down there. So he's got a wall of guitars behind him. It makes focusing on the interview difficult, man. It's very cool. No, it's in a good way. You know, it's like, if, you know, that's not a bad problem to have to look at that. So you've been with the band since 2008. What's the most 2007. Okay, so you've got 10 years. That's a massive, I mean, that's like, you know, 70 dog years. And in a band situation, I don't think it's unreasonable to call it that, right?
Yeah.
What are the most important and most valuable lessons you've learned from this entire experience, from, you know, from the get-go, either musically, business-wise, or performance-wise in playing? What are the biggest takeaways been for you?
The Gosh, that's a lot of separate thoughts. But I mean, one of the biggest things that I've learned is definitely I'd never really done a lot of sideman, quote unquote sideman stuff before this. I'd always played in bands and done that sort of thing, or not that sort of thing. That's what I'd always done as a guitar player. I played in bands.
Sure.
And being a sideman or being a session musician is definitely all about you're working for someone. And it took me a little while to like adjust to that, honestly. And it's good that I was among friends while I was adjusting to that.
That's a really honest answer.
When you play in bands, it's a complete band dynamic, and sometimes you don't agree on points, and so you like sift through them. Whereas when you're a sideman, like in our case in Lady A, like everyone like has their thoughts and everyone has arrangement thoughts, and it's a very creative process. But at the end of the day, the buck stops with the artist. Like if you're doing something that's not what they're feeling, like you do what they're feeling. You don't continue to push what you think that it should be. So it definitely, that particular thing, I remember early on, like it was a thing like I couldn't quite wrap my head around them, where I'd be thinking like, man, that's not a good way to approach this. But it's not my way, it's their way, and that's who I'm working for, and they're paying me to do that. So adjusting to that was something that I said, thankfully, it came pretty quick. But figuring that out was one thing, and figuring it out musically too, because I did come into this Nashville-based, it's not the countryest thing in the world, but it is a country band, and there are just different parts being played than what I was used to. I was always kind of a classic rock guy and a classic kind of R&B soul guy, and you know, a lot of this stuff was just out of my wheelhouse. You know, and same thing, I adapted to it because I realized like, okay, I need to adjust to this, because that's what this job entails, you know, being a player that's being hired to do this job. So that was an adjustment the first few years, and still is. Still there's things that come up where I'm not a huge effects guy, but that's where the format has shifted. Like there's a lot of like squirrely sounding effects on a record that I'm going like, okay, I need to figure out how to make that noise, even though my ideal world is a guitar and a cable and an amp.
Right.
There's those things that like, okay, well that's what is there, and that's what I need to figure out how to do. And so I figured out how to do that.
No, that's a very honest answer, man. I appreciate that. Really very genuine answer. We talked a little bit before. What else are you working on now that you're excited about outside of Lady A?
Man, we kind of just wrapped up our touring year just the other day, but I've got a few irons in the fire. Like there's this this musical theater composer named Scott Allen that I just recently was introduced to through my good friend Diana DeGarmo to do an arrangement for one of his songs for his one of his solo records, and the relationship just flourished very quickly, and it sounds like I'm going to be doing some production work with him for the rest of his record, which is super exciting to me. And it's for both of us, it's completely out of our wheelhouse and out of our comfort zone. And it caught me completely off guard when he asked me to do it, because I'm just going, okay, you must have liked what I did with the first song, and we definitely jived really well, like
it hit musically.
Well, musically, we're on different sides of the fence. But I think that's what appealed to him, is that I was bringing a perspective that was completely foreign to him. Mm. And he's giving me music that I really have to process and think about, and like, how can I steer this more in like my sort of pop mentality? Like, how can I take this where it's still maintaining his sense of drama and his sense of theater and make it a little bit more straight down the middle? 'Cause that's what he brought me in to do on the first song, and that's what I'm bringing to the table on the next batch. But it's exciting to me just because, like I said, it was out of left field, and sometimes these things come out of left field, and you just like, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to sink my teeth into this and see what I can do, because it's a unique opportunity to work on something that doesn't really come along every day. So I'm excited to be doing that. I'm getting a little side project together with a couple of buddies, kind of a rock and roll. I kind of, when I brought it up to these buddies, like I you know, the face is crossed with, you know, the Black Crows and Led Zeppelin and
the Faces, and, yeah, that's a good old band, you know, man.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I just want to do a cool classic rock and roll band, man. That's my thing. And fortunately, it's coming into the long, cold winter when no one has anything to do, and some buddies were down to do it. And it doesn't have a name. We haven't even gotten together yet because our years are still winding down on our road gigs. But excited to do that. So, you know, check my Facebook for details as they come.
And the same thing with the Scott Allen Project. Is that going to be on your Facebook as well?
Same with the Scott Allen Project, okay. Yeah. Awesome. I mean, he's got a website for himself, and I'm sure he'll be keeping people appraised. But, like, I'll definitely be – once we really – get into that, I'm going to be promoting it just because it's super exciting, and he's a very, very well regarded composer in the theater world. And so I'm excited. Just jumping in with a guy like that is really going to be interesting, and I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot. And then there's the other thing I got coming up is a showcase with a buddy named Ryan Sims that I just did his record for a producer named Justin Gray out in LA. It's a real cool, like, roots of Americana rock and roll thing that I got to just Southern rock all over. And doing a little
as a player.
Yeah. I didn't write or produce. I just they sent me the tracks and I recorded. But excited to reconnect with him. He's coming out CMA week early November. We're doing a little showcase, and
that's great, man.
Later this fall, and so yeah,
and you'll really be on it. You'll be on the album.
I am on it's an EP, and I'm on the whole thing. Yeah.
And his name is Ryan Sims.
Yeah. Sims, S-I-M-S.
Awesome. Check that out, everybody.
Yeah. That's cool. All sorts of stuff going on.
I'm teaching
some lessons this fall, and just staying occupied. And then in the meantime, I'm going to be chasing a couple little kids around.
Yeah.
Which is, you know,
I hope you get all these things in the middle of chasing all those kids around.
I think it'll fall into place. Like, I'm not going to spread myself too thin. I'm taking on these projects that I can sink my teeth into and be passionate about. And the rest of the time just going to be family time. Cause it's when you're a touring musician, like, it's rare. Those multi-month periods where you just get to, you know, hang out with your little kids and watch them grow and just be around the family, be around my wife, and so yeah, it's gonna be a good few months.
How many days a year are you out with Lady A?
It's not that bad. This year we probably hit 100-110 like days. Probably, I think, 60-65 shows. Last year I think we did 30 shows because it was sort of they sort of just took a breather, and they went and did their solo projects. That's when I did the Charles Kelly project with him, which I spent more days last year doing solo Charles stuff than I did with Lady A. But it's come to a really good place, I think, where, you know, Lady Antebellum is going to be a great touring entity that, you know, we'll probably end up doing that 60-65 shows a year thing. And the rest of the time, you know, cause everyone's got families, everyone's got kids at this point, and everyone's in a good spot. So I feel like it's, you know, going to that place, and it's great.
That's good. That's what happens after 10 years of doing something, man. I'm glad you're getting to take advantage of that.
It levels off.
Well, no, I mean, you get some freedom, which is nice.
Yeah.
You've earned some freedom. You know?
Early on, it was really, really busy. And that's how that goes. You know, when success starts, like, you know, you chase it. And that's what they did. And they did it really, really well. Mm. That's three people that really understand the business and what needs to be done. And it was a, you know, obviously a massive success for them. And so, we did the grind early on, and now we don't do the grind anymore. We just go play shows and have fun.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
You're originally from California, right?
Originally from Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
And most of my growing up was in Colorado Springs. We bounced around quite a bit, but we got to Colorado Springs when I was 8, and then I moved to LA when I was, I had just turned 18.
Were your dad in the military or something like that?
My dad was in construction, so...
Okay, so
equal amount of moving in that line of work.
Yeah, sure, man.
A lot of bouncing around.
So, what was your childhood like moving around from place? You got to LA when you were 18. What was your childhood like? Omaha and Colorado Springs, I imagine, both pretty cool places.
Omaha's gotten to be a cool place. We left Omaha when I was like 2.5 years old. So I was too little to remember. We were there a lot growing up because my mom's side of the family, they're all there, and my dad's side of the family were there for a little bit, and then they all ended up in Phoenix. My childhood we landed in Colorado Springs when I was 8. And before that, I remember moving and a lot of different places.
Sure.
And a lot of changing schools those first few years. And even when we got to Colorado Springs, we lived in, I guess, three different houses. And so I was in different school districts and kind of jumped from place to place. And, you know, we finally landed when I got to, I want to say, 7th grade. But even then, like, I went to this junior high school that half of the kids went to one high school and the other half went to the other high school. So it was just a constant process of finding myself in new places and making new friends and trying to, you know, find my place in it all. And then honestly, like, it's funny because high school, like, I started playing in the jazz band. And so, you know, became a full-fledged band geek. And that was sort of like my happy place was going in the band room and, like, learning to play instruments and, like, doing orchestra and just kind of whatever I could do to, you know, avoid everything else in high school.
How do you think, all that moving around in the, you know, it's tough as a kid. How do you think that impacted you, good, bad, or otherwise, as you grew up, or even still in maybe how your outlook at things or your own, you know, family life?
You know, I'd like to say maybe it may be, you know, excited to travel because I always have been excited to see new places and stuff. I mean, it's made me appreciate solitude, but it's also made me not want too much solitude. I think it's a funny thing because I like my alone time, but there's a very hard line that's drawn between alone time and lonely time.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Where it's like, solitude is great, loneliness is not, and it's, I don't know how many hours or how many days it is, but, you know, I get to that point where, like, I need to be around people, and I don't know if that's something that rubbed off from all the traveling and moving when I was young and having to make new friends, but, I mean, I'd like to think that having to constantly make new friends, like, maybe that's made me, you know, social.
I would imagine.
Social, because, like, even when I went to college, you know, I moved away and went to California and knew not a soul, obviously, like nobody, and just learned the art of conversation, I guess.
No, I think it's good that you're not a lot of people are comfortable like being alone. Some people are like mental about that they can't, you know, it's good that you're totally comfortable doing that.
Well, like I said, I'm comfortable for a brief period of time and then I get mental.
No, I get it, man. I totally get it.
This run to the UK that we did, we had a lot of days off in hotel rooms. And the first couple were, you know, cool. I'm just like stretched out, you know, watching Netflix or whatever. And then, you know, by halfway through, it was too much time alone in a hotel room. And as it happens, like we, you know, the incident that happened in Vegas, you know, just recently, that happened. I woke up in my hotel room in Amsterdam to go to the airport, and that was happening. Like, wow. We were 7 hours ahead, and so, or sorry, we were 9 hours ahead of Vegas. So, like, I woke up, and that was active shooter. And we got on a plane, and we flew to Manchester, UK, for a day off, and we were playing the same arena where that Ariana Grande concert happened, not 4 months before, with the active shooter in front of the venue. So that was creepy. It was a big, creepy set of emotions when we got to Manchester, and, you know, of course, it was a cloudy, gloomy day, and there's all this.
It's like happening. That in Manchester every day, though. You know,
it's like that in Manchester every day. And so that happening in Vegas, and, you know, the plane landed, and there were more people dead, and we got to the hotel, and there were more people dead, and I'm hearing, you know, from buddies that were hiding from someone shooting at them. And then we went and sat in a hotel room, and I was sitting there by myself in the hotel room and just like stewing on this. And then Tom Petty died, and it was like, so that's what I'm saying. Like, when the solitude becomes like just, it becomes this place of idle minds are the devil's playground.
Yeah, and man.
All that going down, and we crossed that line into like, okay, too much solitude. It was Manchester was a tough scene, man. Like, it was that's when, like, it was funny because I remember when I found out that Tom Petty had passed, like, I literally texted everyone in the band. I said, okay, that's it. That does it, guys. Who's meeting me at the bar? And our trombone player, Ray, was I think everyone else had like fallen asleep or just checked out. But he says, I'll be there. Like, okay. We just went and just sat and just sort of stewed for a little bit. And I was like, thanks. I told him the next day, I'm like, thanks, man. Like, I couldn't have sat in that hotel room any longer.
Well, it's tough being that far away.
Being by myself, but like, yeah. there's a line, man. Like I can't handle it past a certain point.
No, I think that's tough in general. Yeah, it's tough to be like down about something alone, and then when you're alone, not even home, and then you're not even in your own country. It's like
it was a
not,
lot.
It's not unreasonable.
Exactly. Yeah. Totally not. But you know, we get through it, and then you know, we got home, and the family's here, and they were there at the airport with smiles on their faces, and you know, it's all good.
Good, man.
Yeah. But where do we start with that? Oh yeah, moving around.
Moving around. Yeah. No, you covered it, man.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah. That was a roundabout. We took the scenic route, but
no. There. Totally there, man. What was your earliest exposure to music, and like how did that lead you to eventually picking up the guitar and doing what you do?
The earliest musical memories I have are, you know, probably like everybody, like my parents' records, which ranged from Hendrix and the Stones to Barry Manilow and the Oak Ridge Boys. And the two biggest ones, oddly enough, are Kenny Rogers and Neil Diamond. Those were like my parents, all of their records. And those are still like, I still can't get enough of either one of those guys. And then there were also, you know, all that other, you know, Creedence Clearwater Revival was an early thing I remember. I remember hearing Queen when I was a little kid. I remember I have this old car. It's a 76 four-door Nova that my dad bought new.
Those are badass cars back in the day.
It's awesome. And it's a lot. I mean, that car's got just a lot of stories attached to it. But one of them is it came from the factory with an 8-track player. And in 1982, when I was 5 years old, my dad went and got a new car stereo put in with. It was a JVC cassette deck, which is still in there. And so naturally, funny. We went to a music store in the mall, and he bought some cassettes. And he bought Rolling Stones, Hot Rocks, mm-hmm. and he bought...
that was the Greatest Hits, if I remember.
Smash Hits.
Yeah.
And he bought Toto 4.
That's so funny. That was their popular album.
That was a huge, huge record. Mm. And so that's another one of my earliest musical memories, is hearing, you know, Rosanna and Africa and, you know, Make Believe and like all those great songs on the Toto record, and hearing the Stones. Hendrix I didn't get when I was five. It was later. What made me, and this is the rest of the answer to this question, what really made me get into playing guitar that took me over the top, like, I had a guitar and I learned some chords when I was like 10. There was a guitar class at school and it was just something to do. And then I got into, you know, the hard rock of the era, which was Def Leppard and Bon Jovi and Poison and all this stuff. But what really, really did it for me was in 1989, MTV was showing Woodstock the movie. It was the 20th anniversary.
20th anniversary, right.
It was in August of 89. And I was in my bedroom and like... I think I was probably like playing guitar or listening to music or something. And my dad says, "Hey, you should come watch this." And so I went and watched Woodstock, the movie, and the things that leapt out at me that still probably inform my guitar playing, were Alvin Lee of 10 Years After, Rich Havens and his bionic right arm and his massive left thumb. Mm-hmm. And,
right on the top, those fingernails.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the biggest one, you know what's coming, was Hendrix. Yeah. That's what made me get Hendrix, and then Hendrix just got inside of me. And then that kind of like really was the launching pad for me to just be obsessed with classic rock, you know, like that led to, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 on cassette, and just got me totally into just that hippie music scene, and you know, the floodgates were open. And then like really the first songs, there was another guitar class in my junior high school, and I went to that, and we went through the Mel Bay method book.
The Mel Bay method book. I used to play saxophone as a kid. I remember that. He had them in all music, all instruments.
Yeah, everything. And that stuff is still like, it's the best stuff for learning basic, you know, music stuff. But we, once you got through the book in that class, you could just pick out a song to learn, and then you would learn those songs for class. And so I can't remember the order, but... I want to say the first one that I ever learned, the first real song I ever learned to play on guitar, was in fact Stairway to Heaven.
There you go.
Followed by Purple Haze and The Wind Cries Mary.
That's cool, man. That's a classic song.
So from there, that was just always the stuff that really, really spoke to me. Like I got into all the Shredders. I got into Yngwie. I got into Steve Vai and Joe Satriani. But I think I was at an age where I was just listening to it saying, like, there's just no way that I can do that. Which is the wrong mentality to have, but I think it's a good thing because now I don't know how to play that way, but I know how to play like Jimmy Page.
Yeah. That's not a bad thing.
Because I listen to that and it's, you know, all that stuff. It's sloppy. You know, it's not like meticulous and perfect. It's just awesome. And so I'm kind of like, I think if I practice, I could do that.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Alvin Lee. I think he's so, I don't know, he's one of my favorite guitar players. He doesn't come up very much as...
The most underrated guitar player in classical history.
I mean, talk about a shredder. I mean, I wouldn't call him a shredder like, you know, Vai and Satriani, but that guy...
Well, it's like bebop, rockabilly, psychedelic madness, man. Like, it's just... No one else has ever played like that.
No, no one else has played blues like that, which is basically exactly what he did. And he was amazing, man. Great tone and everything.
Absolutely.
When you first started playing professionally, what was the biggest surprise about the business end of being a professional musician? It doesn't have to be bad. I mean, good, bad, or otherwise.
The most surprising thing about the business end. Gosh, I feel like I had an interesting answer for this, and I can't remember what it was. Let's come back to that.
Yeah, that's totally cool, man.
I'm trying to think of like the biggest surprise to me. Yeah, let's come back to that.
It's all good, man. You know, I wrote this question down. I wasn't planning on asking you because, again, I thought you were like, you know, 27 years old. But now that I know you're not, I can ask it to you because you'll have probably some good answers. You know, everybody pays tuition in their career, whatever they're doing. And I was curious if you'd be open to sharing maybe one or two mistakes you made early on that, you know, what you learned from them.
That's an easy answer. And this is literally like guided my life ever since I realized that this is how it works. And maybe this actually goes back to your prior question about the biggest surprise about the business, which shouldn't be surprising, but, and I'm going I keep thinking about this and I say this like pretty frequently, be nice, not to quote, you know, Patrick Swayze as Dalton in Roadhouse, be nice.
No, man.
Because the biggest mistake that I made early on was just coming out swinging and having to be right all the time about musical stuff, playing in bands, particularly like I played in a band with a guy who's still a friend of this day named Joe Firstman. He has a killer band called Cordovas that is just killing it in the Americana scene. But we had a band, it was called Firstman, and we were signed to Atlantic Records. And he and I spent several years just butting heads in like just epic, stubborn, like rhinoceros fashion. Like, we were just both very, very similar, but we were both just complete bastards to each other. And, like, I just saw him the other night, and we're sitting there talking about, you know, that stuff, and it's kind of like, man, if I could go back and just say things different. Like, I think about the conversations we had and the way that he treated his band and the way that I was towards him was just – it was – that band didn't have a chance, and it was great, great band. But that was one of those things, and because I can be a stubborn freaking person. But you know, we were both probably stubborn for the wrong reasons, and I was approaching being in a band as though it had to be some sort of a dictatorship, and I had to like, you know, I had to be right about everything, which is completely the wrong way to be in a band situation. And so it all fell to pieces. They ended up, you know, the band got dropped from the label and they put out the record as Joe Firstman as a solo artist, which that's another story. That's, to me, in my mind, that was in the wake of a guy named John Mayer. Everyone was a singer-songwriter all of a sudden and rock bands didn't exist anymore.
Right.
Like, just really everything just sort of like mellowed out and became singer-songwriter stuff. So as far as what'd you call it, paying tuition?
Yeah. I mean, that's what
that would be the biggest thing to me is being cool with people and being nice to people and to everybody, regardless of if they've got an attitude towards you or not. Like, that is the fact that me and Joe are still friends to this day. It's like, you know, we've both grown up and figured stuff out. It's, you know, and it's all good. It's all water under the bridge. But, you know, that was one of those things. I look back at that band and like, that really could have been something. And not just me, like he'd acknowledge like he would have had to chill out too, but neither one of us was going to back down. and we didn't. And, you know, as a result, it didn't work out. But it also, to fast forward quite a bit, and this is a story that Charles tells people all the time, Charles Kelly, that I think the entire reason that I have this gig is because I was cool with Charles Kelly the first time I met him, because Charles came out to LA when I was playing with his brother. He had just graduated from the University of Georgia, and he looked like a guy that had just graduated from the University of Georgia, like tall, just, you know, baggy khakis and a, you know, pink polo shirt. And he shows up in Hollywood for this. We were playing this show. It was the Joe Firstman, a guy named Tony Luca, and I was playing with Josh. And, you know, and he just stuck out like a sore thumb. And Josh had told me, like, he says, man, my brother's like this melodic genius, man. Like, you got to write songs with him. He's like, he's amazing. And he told everyone this. And everyone was like cordial to Charles, but he just didn't really fit the Hollywood thing at all. And so everyone just kind of didn't really hang out with him. And I remember we, like, after sound check, everyone kind of went their separate ways, and Charles was just sitting there. And I just walked up to him and said, hey, man, do you want to go get a burrito? There's a Baja Fresh up the street. He's like, yeah, sure. We went down there and just got to know each other and hung out. We ended up, you know, I got together to write songs with him, and he was, in fact, a melodic genius. And we were buddies from that day forward. And he came out on the road with us, and, like, we ran around and just partied together. And, you know, he's still one of my best friends. And, you know, I look back in that, and I just say to myself, like, wow, what if I hadn't, you know, been cool to the guy that everyone else wasn't really that cool to? And Charles says that all the time. He says, literally, he says, Slim was the only guy that was nice to me.
No, but that was probably very good, like, validation, you know, for, like, personal growth. I know, like, when things like that happen, it's in my life, it feels good, because it's, you know, it's a validation of some growth that you've made on your behalf, you know.
Oh, totally. And I and honestly, like, it's not like I was a dick to anyone at the time, really, except for Joe and my bandmates. But you know, I like to think I'm generally nice to everybody. Like, I pretty much get along with people.
Sure, sure.
And they don't all turn into Lady Antebellum and be a career because of it.
Yeah.
But that particular thing, it's like, be nice.
Yeah.
Like, just be cool with people, because you never know if, like, the tall, gangly, you know, golf-looking dude in the corner of the club in Hollywood is going to end up being Charles Kelly.
You know, I literally had this exact same conversation with, do you know Danny Rader?
Yeah, of course.
And we were talking about, he was talking about something, that he had a similar situation, and, you know, the big takeaway for him was exactly what you said. It was, you know, being right, you know, being nice is basically a lot more important than being right.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I mean, it was almost verbatim the same thing. And I think it was a music situation. The circumstances were different, but it was a musical situation where it was like a misunderstanding. And I'm not speaking, it was, you know, something we talked about on the show, so I'm not speaking, yeah, like, personally. But, my response to that was that one thing, being, you know, nice is more important than being right. For me, that's been I've been married 25 years, and that's been the thing that is sort of like,
yeah, that can guide a marriage as well. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, that was like something that was, man, you know what? It's not that important being right. I want this thing to be lasting, and, you know, I just need to be nice. So, I mean, that's such a value. You know, it sounds cliched, but it's really important. And
it seems obvious, but it's important to always be conscious of that. For,
yeah,
sure.
For sure, man. Let's look at the flip side. What are there one or two particular things you've done, which at the time were a bit out of your comfort zone, that turned out to be really in your best interest? And maybe, I mean, this was one of them.
Lady Antebellum was definitely one of them. That would be the top of the list.
Because of the style of music.
I didn't realize how out of my comfort zone it was at the time, and how much, when I look at it, how much adaptation that I ended up doing over those first couple of years. And again, if it was around anyone other than my good friends, like, it might not have worked out quite as well, because they would have been way less tolerant of me. Just like, I just didn't play the way that people play on Nashville gigs.
Yeah.
And I still don't really fall into that thing, but I can definitely, like, fake it well enough, and I can definitely adapt my style of playing.
Yeah, I'd say adapt. I don't think faking it is probably.
Adapt would be the better way to put it. But yeah, that would definitely be at the top of the list. Would just be Lady Antebellum, and so it doesn't really get any bigger than that. As far as outside of my comfort zone, that's
paid off.
Whoa!
What was that?
That's my. You know, like your phone's tied to your laptop.
Yeah.
I called my phone and my laptop.
Your laptop's going off. No worries, man.
But anyway,
hey, let's talk about some gear. As I'm looking at, I got to just ask you that Telecaster right behind you, over your left ear. What is that? Is that it? Is that an aged relic or is that like an actual?
The second one over.
Yeah, with the
guy down in Tucson. It's called Balance. And I think he's, oddly enough, I think he's making mostly cigar box guitars now. But Balance is the name of his company, and it was a build. It's a swamp ash Tele with a toasted maple neck.
Yeah, because
reverse Strat headstock.
Okay,
and it's great, man. The pickups in there are from a company called Rio Grande. That's a friend of mine in Texas, and it's just a killer, spanky. Filthy Tele. So it's kind of my go-to. I don't have a legit country chicken picking Tele because I just don't really do that well, but that's definitely just a badass rock and roll Tele.
And that is that a proper Fender underneath it, the canary yellow?
No, that's and the Sunburst next to it. I don't know if you can see it. Those three Strats, the Blonde and the Sunburst are both from a company called Big Tex down in Texas. Go figure.
He
builds Strats and Tellies and does relic work, but in my opinion, he's one of the best builders that does that kind of thing. His necks feel amazing. He oils them with gunstock oil and they just feel glorious. And then the third one is an actual Fender. It's just an American Standard Tele that I put Rio Grandes in, and it's my maple neck. It's my white, Hendrix Strat.
Yeah. It's amazing. I don't think a phone call or a conversation I have with a musician goes by where I don't learn about a new boutique-ish guitar company, and it's always oh my God, this thing is amazing. And it's just it's amazing how many people are – and I think that's a big reason for, a lot of the sales that in drop off of Fender and Gibson, because you got so many other people that for a few dollars more, they're doing something more custom and it's great quality.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, and it's in some cases not even for more. If you were comparing those custom builds to a Fender custom shop thing,
it's a lot less probably.
I can't compare quality. I've never owned a custom shop, but I've played a couple in there. They're phenomenal. You can't take away from that stuff. But yeah, people are looking to other places because the fact is that there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of guys that are building, and most of them are really, really great. It's a good thing and a bad thing, but I agree with you. I think that's why, you hear about this huge decline in guitar sales. You're only looking at the big manufacturers. It's not that no one's buying guitars. It's just that, people have more options.
Yeah. And if I'm talking to professional musicians and guys like you are on the other side saying, this is a great guitar, could you imagine what the average layperson is? They're going to be that much more blown away because your standards are going to be a lot tougher. So, it's just there's a lot of good manufacturers out there, man.
Yeah. Competition theoretically should breed quality. So.
I think it's great, personally. I'm a capitalist, man. I think competition's great,
Yeah, I hear you.
What's your go-to guitar right now, if you have one? And what other two or three guitars would round out your top ones?
Well, I think I told you my go-to guitars on tour would have to be that Ibanez Eric Krasno model, I'm not allowed to say this, but it's a 335. It's their version of a 335,
sure.
Which they make several, and it's the Eric Krasno. I've got Seymour Duncan Seth Lovers in it, it's great, man. The guys at Ibanez, they're known for shredhead guitars, but I always forget that in the 70s these guys were making arch tops. And they're making semi hollows for decades now, and it's Japanese craftsmanship, which is second to none. So I feel like because they make shredder guitars too, they've taken this format of the semi-hollow and made it kind of less stiff and more playable. Because for me, like, the 335 thing can get a little bit cumbersome. Like, it's almost an acoustic guitar quality sometimes. But the Krasno, like, it's not super, it's not slinky, but it's just really, really playable. It's very, very well built.
And it's actually, look at that guitar. So who is Eric Krasno? I don't know that name.
He's in a band called Soul Live, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm honestly not, I'm not really familiar with his playing at all. I just thought it looked cool and wanted to check one out, and then I got it. It's just, it's great, and it's just become a go-to. It just feels great and sounds amazing. That and my old, like, I got a Les Paul Gold Top from, like, 2000 that I've had since then, and it's just been raked over the coals. It's just destroyed, but I've done all the destruction work myself, which is satisfying. Those are my go-to road guitars, my go-to in-town studio guitars. Like, the one I've been coming back to the most lately is this. I just got it not long ago. It's a 68 SG Standard. It's the SG at the far end. That, and then that Gold Top right there is from 1970.
Wait a minute. That Gold Top, that's not the one you were talking about.
No. That's a different one.
Okay.
Long story as to why I have two Les Paul Gold Tops. But that is...
Whose autograph is on there?
That's Les Paul and Slash.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So that's always been a go-to. I've had that guitar since I was 12. That was my first, like, real guitar. I got that from my second cousin, or maybe not even by blood, like my second cousin's husband, for $275 when I was 12.
Holy smokes. How did that miracle happen?
He had it, and he knew I was playing guitar and wanted to get an electric guitar. And the funny thing is, at the time, I was saving my money to get an Ibanez 770, because that's what was hip at the time. And Les Pauls were like, Slash was playing Les Pauls, but it wasn't like my scene right then and there. And so I was like, I don't know. But my mom and dad actually convinced me to get that from my cousin, because it was, I remember distinctly, like, I offered him $200 and he wanted $5, and we landed at $275. And I look back on it, it's like, I think it offered $275. It's been routed out. It used to, it's a deluxe. It used to have mini humbuckers. It had been routed out. It had these DiMarzios in it, and all of the plastic parts had been replaced with mirrored chrome. And so there's a little toggle switch, like a coil tap switch, that there's a hole drilled in it for that. And it's got like 57 classics in
those
it now.
Man, I have those on an SG. Those are freaking phenomenal pickups, man. I love those.
It's never failed me. That's what's in my other Gold Top too, and
they're 57 great. Classic. Yeah, they're really wonderful. I like them much better than the Burst Buckers.
Yeah, Burst Buckers can get a little hot, a little jarring.
Yeah.
Although actually, that Rich Robinson has got Burst Bucker 2s, and they're pretty cool. It gives a little extra howl, but yeah, those are some go to guitars. Like I've got probably like 7 or 8 that are the ones that I always take into the studio that are the ones that really get used. And then there's, all the other stuff hanging out. That orange one over my right shoulder is actually a favorite too. That's a Yamaha.
Oh, it's a Yamaha.
Yeah, it's a Yamaha. It's called an AES 1500B. And it's got, the pickups are sort of like P90-ish, I guess, but it does a lot of different things. It's a really cool guitar.
Any cool stories besides the one you just said about the one you got for $275? Any cool stories about some of the guitars you got?
Oh, that would be the coolest story for sure. Let me look around the room. That 67 355 is interesting, because I actually bought that. I used to work at a music store in Colorado Springs called The Music Exchange, and that was hanging on the wall, and I bought it when I was, I guess, 21 or 22, and got a really good deal on it because it had replaced pickups. There were no covers on the pickups, and so they were replaced pickups. It had the tailpiece was not original to it, and those things drive the prices down on that stuff. It needed a refret, and yada yada yada. But so I got a good deal on it, and I came just a couple years ago. I finally I wanted to get the pickups sort of rewired, because it had like this weird middle pickup, like the Peter Green mod, this out of phase thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It was cool to have, but I never used it. I'd rather just have like the actual middle position. So I was getting it rewired, and while the pickups were out, I asked the tech, I'm like, "What? By the way, I was always told that these were non-original pickups." And I said, do they have like patent number stickers on them? He says, yeah, these are patent numbers. It's all the original solder. He's like, these are original pickups.
Wow.
To the shop, they didn't actually check. They just saw that there were no covers on them and made the assumption that they were non-original pickups.
Holy smokes.
So it's like, it's original. I got some aged covers put on it just for the appearance.
Yeah.
Still non-original parts on the guitar, but it's, so yeah, that's one of those funny things. Like I scored a deal because they didn't bother to take the pickups out and look at them. They're patent number pickups. So unless someone replaced the pickups with patents,
yeah, that would be kind of
because the solder's super old, or it was before I got it rewired. But
that's wild, man. Those are. Yeah. Do you know John Shaw?
John Shaw, I don't.
Yeah, I think he's Josh Turner's guitarist. He's in Nashville, and he's really smart and buys and sells a lot of guitars. And he said that's one of his reliable, you know, ways of getting good guitars. You find something that's old, that's had something replaced, and all of a sudden, you know, because it's not original, the value goes down. But you know, you get it for a really cheap price, and then, you know,
yeah,
you get a lot of equity in there.
I think that kind of stuff is drying up because people are, it's funny because like you always say, like, oh yeah, non-original pickups, it should like, you know, cut the price down by 20%. But yet you look at listings of that stuff and people selling it don't seem to realize that. And people buying it don't seem to care as much as sort of the collector snob market seems to think that they should.
Yeah, this is true.
Like, I feel like, you know, very few guitars are like actually collectible by collector standards.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, you know, but that one
like,
is...
My 68 SG, like the guy that I got it from is a good buddy of mine. He's a vintage dealer down in Houston. And I traded him a bunch of stuff for it. And I love it. But he says, yeah, for me, it's if it's not like a 61, 62, 63, like, you know, the Les Paul that's not called an SG yet. Yeah. You know, that with, I guess there's like the nut width is slightly wider. He says, yeah, they're just too narrow. And I'm like, and that's a collector. He even said, he's like, I'm such a collector snob. Like if it's not before 63, like I don't want it. Right. I'm like, it's from freaking 68. It's from the Summer of Love, man.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That guitar's got stories.
Oh, hell yeah. I know what you mean, man. It depends how you're, you know, depends what your OCD triggers on, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Something or someone you miss from your childhood?
Oh, I mean that's easy. That would be my dad. I mean, he passed away when I was 20, and
sorry.
So thanks, man. It's, you know, it's actually it's funny because I guess yeah, it's been officially half my life now, and you know, he was always my best buddy, and again, it was a long time ago. There's times, you know, I think like, boy, I wish my dad was like could see this. And like, you know, I've managed to carve out a successful, you know, career as a musician, and you know, I've done a lot of really cool things, and you know, would have been nice to share that stuff with them.
And now you had your second child too, which is real nice.
Yeah, and it's and my son's middle name is Gregory, which is my dad's first name. So
that's nice.
Yeah, but so yeah, definitely miss my old man.
It's all good. If you weren't doing what you're doing now, Slim, what do you think you'd be doing instead?
That's an interesting question. I used to do in LA. I did systems integration work. Like I wired up post production facilities, and it was super technical work. And a lot of it was, you know, planning, and a lot of it was installation. A lot of it was troubleshooting and fixing stuff. And there's definitely a big part of me that like my brain works that way. And like my favorite thing was when something would break and fixing it. So I think I would be doing something along those lines, or I grew up working on cars with my dad. That's fallen off substantially since he passed. Like I mean, I just don't do it anymore.
Sure.
But I might have gone down that road. Or I also, when our band got signed, I was in graduate school at UCLA to become a history professor.
Wow. So, that's a pretty big dichotomy between working on cars and building shit and a history professor.
I know it's a big leap.
Yeah. Well, it's really different. Well, yeah,
it didn't see that coming, did you?
No. Me, a mechanic or history professor?
Yeah. And I think I'm not sure which one of those would be more or less likely. Like the history professor, I got through one quarter of it, and then our band got signed, but I would have had another, you know, almost 6 years to the PhD. And I'm not entirely sure if I would have survived that because it was.
That's a lot of education.
That few months was like I was working full time doing wiring work, doing tech work, and I was going to UCLA. You know, full-time graduate school course load. And I was playing in three different bands, and one of them was showcasing for labels. So it was, I didn't sleep for that period of time. And like, you know. So I don't know how grad school would have ended up working out. I'm not sure if that was where I was meant to be headed, and that's why I think, it all fell into place the way it was supposed to.
I think we've already come to the conclusion, Slim, that it's this lack of sleep, which is resulting in your freaking anti-aging regimen or something.
Yeah, you know, I've heard lack of sleep definitely helps you live longer.
I don't know. What was it like going to school at UCLA? I mean, that's a massive campus and, you know, a hotbed of, you know, cultural uprising. What was your experience there like?
It was my experience there was very limited. I was there, you know, a couple days a week, and I went to class, and then I left and went and read books and wrote papers. And I spent a lot of time in the libraries. And so the funny thing is, like, you know, I went to USC as an undergrad, which is the big crosstown rival. But graduate school, like, you don't really have time to get involved with campus politics. I mean, some people do, but I don't know how. So getting involved with stuff that goes on
campus. Wait a minute. I'll tell you exactly how.
Team, like,
someone's paying for everything and it's not them. That's exactly how.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. If you're being bankrolled, you can get away with that. Yeah. But if you're working to pay your bills and to eat while you're also trying to go to school, like, I think, you know, a lot of people are.
Yes.
Actually, maybe at this point, maybe not. That was almost 20 years ago now when I think about it. But it's all gotten so expensive that you almost got to be bankrolled to go get a history PhD to go be a college professor. Like, there's no money in that. So you can only go so deeply into debt. But so my experience was really like libraries and classrooms and just it's all kind of a hazy blur because I was just so. I came up with so many new exciting tricks to keep myself from sleeping and to keep myself awake, like make it as uncomfortable as possible to sleep, because I was awake all the freaking time, man. So that was my experience, was just sleep deprivation.
I hear you. Most important person in your life and why?
Oh, it would be, you know, three-way tie, my wife, my son, and my daughter. You know, I know I'm supposed to say, does anyone say not their wife? Does anyone actually like say that?
Let me think.
I mean, they're the,
you know, it's really funny. Like, this is very interesting of timing. I cannot tell you how many times I've asked that question and the wife comes walking just like, you know, we've been going for 58 minutes now. No one's here. Right. All of a sudden, you know, the wife comes walking through and it's like, holy shit, it's almost like the ghost or something, you know.
Yeah.
And that's frequent. But yeah, usually people say that, the wife. Yeah. I'm reluctant to ask it sometimes because I don't want to force, you know, I want someone to be honest, but it's, musicians are weird. Most of the guys that I've spoken to, as like, I come from a business background, so most of the guys I've spoken to that are musicians are actually really into their wives.
Yeah, well, that's because it takes a special kind of woman to deal with the kind of schedules we keep and the kind of weird lives that we lead. I mean, like, you're leaving town all the time. And, you know, quite frankly, like, we get to do, like, our jobs are a blast. Like, you know, the travel is the tough part, and the downtime is the tough part. But it's like, we go play shows and hang out with our buddies and, you know, drink beer with them and, you know, meet people. And it's like, from a purely, you know, job standpoint, I mean, that's a joke, man. Like, that's not real work. And so there's times, you know, especially when you have little kids that, you know, our wives are home and they're like holding down the fort and taking care of the kids. And like, they have a crappy day. And, you know, we're out there like having a blast.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, again, there are dark days, there's tough days on the road, but at the end of the day, no, we're out there playing music.
Yeah. No, but I think,
for our wives to deal with that and accept that. And none of them accept it fully. Like, there's times where it's like, wow, I'm home. I don't get to do anything fun. And you're always out having fun. It's like, well, yeah, this is my job. I have to do it. Like, I gotta keep food on the table. But it's like, I get it. So I think that's why musicians are into their wives, because if they have a wife in the first place, it means they found someone that really deals with that kind of crap. On some level.
Yeah, but I think that is mutually, my opinion anyway, I think everything you're saying is true, but if you're running a business, any business, your life as an entrepreneur is hectic and really hectic and busy. And some guys are out of town and some guys are not, but you're working 18-hour days often. And I just see in the music industry, I've just been blown away how many guys are so, you know, openly like, you know, just into their spouse. And maybe it's also an aspect of, you know, creative people in general are probably more willing to express their feelings about a relationship.
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
But it's always,
if you're spending a lot of time out of town, you also there is a certain thing to the, you know, the maxim that absence makes the heart grow fonder. I mean, I think that, you know, we don't really have as much time to get sick of each other.
Yeah, man, very true.
You know, 8 months from now when I go back on the road, like, it might be a different story. But, you know, so far we haven't had a chance.
We'll talk.
Yeah, right.
So, yes, your wife and your two kids. Most important thing your dad taught you?
I think my dad definitely instilled in me just general work ethic and just committing myself to stuff. I mean, he I always remember him telling me, like, if you're going to do something half-assed, like, just don't even bother starting. Don't waste everybody's time. I guess that's made me, you know, commit to things, mostly in the past. Like, there's times now that I'm just coasting. It's like, it's a good place to be. And like, not that I don't have any hustle anymore, but I definitely spent, you know, the first, 15 years of chasing this stuff, like just going all the time. Not the 3 months of grad school notwithstanding, I was still always the guy that was just constantly out and constantly hustling and constantly like go and working and trying to accomplish something. I think I had that instilled in me from an early age. And, you know, my dad was a blue collar construction guy. And so I came from this, like, you know, Midwestern Catholic blue collar guilt background of, like, you know, you work, you get up in the morning and work. Like, we got up Saturday mornings and worked on the cars, or I mowed the lawn, or, you know, stuff like that. And so to this day, like, I can't sleep. And like, I have, even if I have nothing in particular to do, like, I have to get up. And even if I don't do something, it's like, I can't sleep. I have to get up. And again, back to the not sleeping thing.
Yeah.
They're just the voices are just,
I think we've discovered, I think we need to pursue this thing here, man. I smell info product. And how about mom? What's the most important thing your mom taught you?
My mom, I wish this would rub off on me more, but my mom is instilling me to freaking chill out sometimes. Like, you know, my mom also has always worked really hard. I mean, I remember growing up, like, she would be working full time. Sometimes she worked like a night job and then, you know, get us up in the morning and get us off to school. And I always remember, like, my mom, I've told her this recently, like, there were times, like, I don't know when or if my mom slept, like, for years.
She looked young?
Years, but she was always, she does. She looks very young. Dude, and she has a smile on her face.
This is, we've closed this deal. Info, like, product.
Yeah, right.
100%.
She's always done everything with a smile on her face and has, like, gone through just some, you know, a lot of terrible crap in her life. And she's a breast cancer survivor, like, I think 12, 14 years, like, a long time.
Good for, you know, her, man.
She was diagnosed 2 years after my dad died of cancer. And so it was a very dark period, but she like went through all that stuff also just with a smile on her face. And like, so she's like the most positive influence I could possibly have in my life. And, you know, it annoys me sometimes because it's kind of like, stop being so positive.
Don't be so happy.
Like, is awesome. But, you know, I think just enough of that rubs off where like I can find the optimist in myself and you know,
find the silver lining.
Yeah. Totally. So that's, my mom's just all love and all just happiness and just has such an amazing spirit. And so, you know, my mom and my dad are very, very opposites from one another. But I mean, it's a, you know, good balance.
Good. It seems you got some real, very good work ethic, spirit from both of them though.
Yeah.
Good role models for that, which is important.
Big time.
What's your superpower, man?
Oh yeah, my superpower.
Yeah,
I, this is gonna sound stupid, but like I think I'm a freaking great dad. Like I think I'm
That's awesome.
I think I'm crushing that.
Good. That's wonderful, man.
So we were on the fence about having kids in the first place, like, not because we didn't want them, but it was sort of like, yeah, we can have kids or not. Like, either way, we'll be happy. I've always loved kids, but being a dad is my superpower, man. And like, it's great.
That's awesome, man. That's nice to hear. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
I need a hobby. Not really. I used to have a hobby. It was playing guitar.
It's playing guitar. You know what? I asked, you know, Adam Schoenfeld?
Yep, sure do.
I asked him this question. I said, do you have any hobbies outside of music? He goes, yeah, guitar. But the whole interview was like that. I was in stitches like the whole time, man.
That's amazing. I need a hobby. I'm a collector. I've always liked to collect stuff, and lately that's been a lot of like, you know, buy, sell, trade gear. Hmm. So it's kind of, you know, it can be an expensive hobby, but I'm usually right around even with the buying and selling and trading stuff. But that's fun. Like, I like to, you know, learn about gear and stuff. But no, I don't have what would be considered a proper hobby, and I need one, and I keep on like thinking I should get one, but I also don't know when I would pursue it right now. So, you know, one of these days.
Yeah, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears, kind of thing.
Right,
I'm sure it'll happen. Hey, you've been all over. Favorite place you've traveled?
Gosh. I've been asked that, and I've thought about it a lot. Like, I've never come up with a great answer. Like, there's so many great cities in the world. Like, I love London. Actually, you know what? I would say my favorite places, I would say these are my favorite places because they're places that I would be willing to live. Hmm. There's four of them. I love Ireland. We went to Costa Rica on our honeymoon. Costa Rica is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle.
Beautiful there, man. I've been there.
Pacific Northwest and Austin, Texas. So those are probably my four favorite places that I've spent any amount of time.
What do you like about Austin? Just the music scene there?
No, the music scene is like kind of okay in my mind. Like there's a lot of like indie stuff and a lot of Texas music and, you know, a lot of good stuff in there, but not necessarily my scene. Like, I just kind of like the energy and the vibe. Like, it's a strange place. It's getting... Nashville is sort of following Austin in the, you know, there's a lot of high rises and there's a lot of like, you know, and like people moving because it's like, it's a cool city to move to. But no, I would just have a really good time there. And I love kind of, you know, the old houses. And I do like that there's like a full on indie music scene. Like, a lot of it is not my cup of tea, but a lot of it is.
Man, so, you ever heard of the Rocket Boys?
I have not.
They're out of Austin. They're a pretty good band.
Nice.
Sorry for whatever that's worth. Just kidding. I thought you might have known. Dork. Dang. No, sorry.
I'm into it.
Anything you're currently? There's gonna be three questions left. First one. Anything you're currently trying to improve on? It could be musically, personal, business, anything else.
I need to get out more and shake more hands and kiss more babies, because that was always my thing. Is like I was always kind of out and about and meeting people, and that's where, you know, music stuff comes from. And I've definitely like, I've always had an internal homebody, but it's really like when I'm home, like I'm home and I want to be with my family. And, you know, I just want to like, you know, chill, but I kind of, Nashville has changed in the meantime. And there's a lot of new people here and like a lot of scene changes. And so I kind of need to get back out and about. So I want to improve upon that. Musically, like I always have the intention of just practicing more stuff that's outside of my comfort zone. I want to get back into playing more like jazz, just for kicks, just for the sheer like doing something different. And I always go on little kicks where I sit there and like practice bop lines and like, you know, mess with jazz tunes and then get sidetracked. So I kind of want to get into more of a practice regimen where I want to be a constantly improving, evolving guitar player. Because it's been like slow progress lately, just because like I'm in my thing, and I play professionally now, and so I do what I do, and it being a job, like, it's hard to see it as like, oh, this, you know, sort of the hobby aspect of it, of like, yeah. Well, I'm gonna spend an hour a day, like, this is fun and this is cool. So I kind of want to try to get back into, you know, blocking out some time every day to do that. Whether or not that will happen with the two little kids is anybody's guess, but that's the goal.
What guitar do you play jazz to usually? I mean, you got a number of them, but which is your, what do you tend to gravitate to?
You know, for proper jazz, you know, that D'Angelico back there.
Yeah. How are those? I've never played one of those.
They're pretty rocking, man. I mean, they're very affordable jazz boxes. That's of course one of the new ones. The old ones cost $30,000, so I don't have one of those, but I'm actually like, I might do a trade with a dude here in town for a like 69 ES-175 that I hope works out, because I think that will motivate me to do more jazz stuff.
Is that the sharp point?
Yes.
Yeah, those are nice looking. You know, some of those, D'Addario, they're making new, some of their newer models are like rock. You know, they have one that came out now. It's like a great, it's got a British flag or an American flag, and they have another one like a Grateful Dead guitar,
I think I want to say like Bob Weir signature.
Yes, but I was like, oh, okay, that's weird. I didn't know that about them. I've never heard one or played one.
They're always trying to, like, I have a couple of good friends that are actually artist reps for D'Angelico, and they I have two of their guitars, and they're fantastic, but they want to be known not as guys that make jazz boxes. They want to, because they have sort of, you know, a single cut solid body. You know, I'll just say it's their Les Paul, you know, their double humbucker thing. They have like their 335 style of thing.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And they're great. Like our other guitar player, Clint, actually has one of those, and he loves it. So they're trying to rebrand themselves, because it's, you know, it's some guys that bought the name. You know, it's the original company.
I didn't know. I said D'Addario. Sorry, I meant D'Angelico.
Yeah. I knew what you were talking about. But yeah, so they're trying to be known beyond the jazz archtop world.
Yeah.
But that being said, like, they make really great jazz archtops. So, you know, it could be tough to overcome. But I know a lot of guys are starting to really, really dig on their 335 style center block things. And I don't know anyone that has one of the solid bodies, but you know, who knows? But they are making all kinds of stuff.
Toughest decision you've ever had to make, or the hardest thing you've ever had to do so far?
Man, I as far as tough decisions, like, I haven't run into one of those situations where it was kind of like a life and death decision, honestly. Like, I was thinking about that, and I didn't come up with anything huge. Like, I'd like to say, oh, moving to Nashville, but it's like, I've found, as much as like I tend to be really intense and I overthink everything, like, I am the OCD overthinker crazy person. Like, that's one of the things that keeps me up at night. Like, I overthink every damn thing. So, like, in my mind, everything's a life or death decision. But I never make any of the decisions. Like, stuff, for some reason, for me at least, has always sort of shown itself where it just becomes, like, so obvious where it's like, okay, that's what I should do. And there's times when just, like, something comes up where it seems difficult, but I'm kind of like, no, obviously this is what I'm going to do. Like, where I just feel it, and I'm kind of like, no, I'm gonna do that.
That's great. I'm happy that you haven't had to be in that situation, man. That's why you're so damn young looking. We'll get to the bottom of this by the end of this call. Yeah. No, it's a lot less stress when you, although you said you analyze everything, which is a lot of stress.
The stress, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of stress.
I'm not lacking for stress. I make a big deal out of things that shouldn't be a big deal, probably.
Sorry, a lot of people do that.
Yeah, it's typical.
Last question, man. And you've been a real pleasure, and I'm really glad that I know it's really hard to connect. I'm really happy that I appreciate your time. What's your definition of happiness? Bearing in mind that changes, of course.
Gosh, definition of happiness. Happiness really does. I remember seeing, you know, the comic Dennis Leary had this
He's
record that I just wore out when I was, you know, a teenager, called No Cure for Cancer. And he had this one little bit. He says, happiness comes in small doses. It's an ice cream cone. It's a 5-second blowjob. It's like, it's the little things that you have brief bits of happiness.
Wait, 5 seconds.
The rest of it. it's always so because it's like, it's funny, you know, his delivery. I was like, ah, that's really funny. But it's like, no, it is. Like, it's all those like little moments that like, that's happiness. It's not like, there's no, in my mind, for me, it's not like some broad sweeping, like, ah, everything's awesome. Cause stuff always comes up that's a pain in the ass. It's a big freaking drag. Like,
you sounded just like him right now when you said that.
That sucks. No, I'm a ranter.
You sound just like him when you said that. That's a big freaking.
It's true. Cause it's like, you know, just when everything is like settled and content, you know, life pops up and like there's some stupid thing you got to deal with and it sucks. But then you deal with it and then like, oh, your kid runs across the room and gives you a hug. It's like, that's freaking happiness, man. Like, that's happiness. Or like, you know, or I walk away from a show saying like, hell yeah, I entertained the shit out of those people. Like, that was great. You know, I'm very happy right now. Or, you know, the first sip of like a really badass local IPA, you know, I say, damn, that's, I'm very happy. I feel really good. Or just, you know, whenever I come home from a trip and like, you know, the family's, you know, happy to see me because they missed me. Like, I think it's all of those like little moments of just like that surge of just gratitude. That's what happiness is to me. I don't think it's some like massive broad sweeping concept. At least for me, it's not, because, you know, that's too grand of a concept, because there's too many things that are out there trying to take away from people's happiness to just say like, I am happy all the time. But I guess the way to have consistent happiness is to like accept that those things pop up, deal with them at the time, and then get back to finding moments of happiness.
That's a real good answer. But, you know, it's like that line that you want to make God laugh, tell him your, or whatever your spirit entity is, you know, tell him your plans, you know. It's always, you're right.
I always reference that. I heard it as a Yiddish proverb. I also heard it attributed to Woody Allen, but so I don't know where it came from, but it was simple. It was just, man plans, God laughs.
Yeah, yeah, right. It's true. Very true, man.
And I say that all the time whenever we're trying to like get out of the house and go do something, and it takes forever to wrangle the kids, and then it just doesn't go as planned.
And then it starts raining. What is it? Man plans and God laughs. I like that.
Yeah, right. It's a very concise way to say. It is
very concise. Hey, man, what? Where could people find you online, and you know, anything you want to promote at all?
Man, I'm excited. I would say anyone that wants to see what I'm up to, like, I'll just check in on the old Book of Faces. If you search Jason Slim Gamble, GAMBILL, I can't even remember what the actual, you know, backslash is. But if you search, I think if you put in Jason Slim, it'll probably be the first thing that comes up.
Yeah, I don't think there's hundreds of Jason Slims.
When I'm doing something, I'm especially this stuff coming up, the Ryan Sims project, the Scott Allen project is hopefully going to end up, you know, coming together and going to be a big cool thing for me, and my personal side project, which I haven't been able to say in quite a few years, like, oh, I'm putting a band together and trying to do something. So yeah, that'd be the way to keep up with stuff. And you know, and I'm always you know, teaching and doing Skype lessons and all that stuff. So same thing. The easiest way to access me is through, I hate to say it, but through Facebook.
No, that's great, man. So yeah, that's great that, you know, if you could take a lesson from the lead guitar player from Lady Antebellum, check him out online. Or if you know he's a great player already, just go to Facebook. That's a pretty good opportunity.
Yeah, I'm easy to find on there.
Man, and if you come out with an album, just come back on the show. Let's discuss it, because the show's growing and I'd love to promote
for sure.
It. I would absolutely love to.
I'm a little side project. We'll turn into some recording and just kind of, you know, be able to actually say, hey, look, this is my thing.
Awesome. Awesome. I'd love to promote it, man. Absolutely. Hey, listen, you've been really, really good to talk to and get to know, and I appreciate your time, and I'm really glad you're back home. You get to enjoy yourself for a little bit in your family.
Thanks so much for having me, man. It's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome. Likewise. All right, buddy. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Jason Slim Gamble as much as I did. And by the way, that is such an Oklahoma name, Jason Slim Gamble. I mean, like, you said Nebraska. Sorry. When you said I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, I'm like, fuck, that makes so much sense. You should have. I could just
all over Oklahoma also when I was a kid. So it's funny you.
You know, I could just see like hundreds of guys called like Slim Gamble walking around up there with cowboy boots and jeans. As soon as you said that, it was like, ching, you know, I saw them all right in front of me. Anyway, man, thank you again for all your time. I really appreciate it. And thanks for being so open and honest and transparent and vulnerable and all those good adjectives, which you are. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com and sign up to get notified about future episodes along with some other cool stuff. Be nice. Be nice. There you go. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, I'm out. Thanks for listening. Peace, y'all. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.